there's no faster way to form a relationship with a patient than sharing a laugh. That is absolutely 100% the fastest way to develop rapport. If you can make someone laugh in 2 or 3 minutes, you might as well spend 30 minutes with them.
This is Meaningful Medicine. In a challenging and unpredictable world with high burnout rates, this is a podcast where incredible individuals share their most meaningful patient experiences and focus on those moments of positivity and joy that sparked their love of healthcare and changed the way they practice medicine.
Hi, I'm Nicole Hohenstein, and I'm an emergency medicine resident at UCSF.
Hi, I'm Shiva Kayambashi. I'm a doctor and professor of family and community medicine at UCSF.
We're the co-hosts of Meaningful Medicine. We created this podcast to highlight stories of healthcare professionals who have found a sense of meaning, resilience, and joy in their work.
Hey, Shiva, how are you doing?
Hey, Nicole. I'm doing really well today. I'm really happy to see you. I always look forward to our times together. I'm wondering how you're doing today.
I am doing well. As you know, I am between nights, so definitely becoming the vampire that I often am. But quite excited for today's interview. We are so lucky to be having an incredible comedian onto the podcast, Dr. Will Flannery, also known as Dr. Glockenflecken, to discuss laughter and comedy and really just his life story in medicine today.
I'm really excited about it too, Nicole. We should just jump right in.
Dr. Will Flannery, also known as Dr. Glockenflecken, is an American comedian and ophthalmologist. He graduated from Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College and was trained in ophthalmology at the University of Iowa. Since 2016, he has become well-known and has gained a large social media following for making and uploading medical satire skits on Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube. Dr. Flannery uses his platform to shed light on different topics, including the flaws of the American healthcare system and the global inequity with COVID vaccine accessibility. Welcome, Dr. Flannery.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
We are really excited to have you, Dr. Flannery. Welcome to our podcast. We are huge, huge, huge fans.
Thanks.
I mean, I know you have millions of them, but we are several of them here.
Oh, it's wonderful. I'm so glad. I wouldn't be here without the people watching the video, so I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're really thrilled to have you and to be a part of it. And we each have our own favorite things to share, but we want to always begin our podcast each time by starting with asking our guests if you could, in short, share a meaningful moment from sometime early in your training or in your life that was particularly impactful or formative as an experience.
The first one that jumped to my mind is the first time I met an ophthalmologist, which was, I don't know, maybe the second week of med school. I was assigned to an advisor. Every med student had an advisor at Dartmouth, and mine just happened to be an ophthalmologist. And at that point, I had no idea what kind of doctor I wanted to be. I came in, I was a completely undifferentiated, pluripotent med student. And so I remember in that conversation, she was a very nice woman named Sue Pepin, and just fantastic ophthalmologist. And I remember at one point asking her, wait, so ophthalmology, that's eyes, right? Like I had no idea. I didn't even know what it was. I had never seen an ophthalmologist growing up. I didn't wear glasses. I had no idea other than it was a job that had a funny name to it. And then she explained to me, yes, I'm an eye doctor. And I was like, surgery, right? And she's like, yes, yes, we do eye surgery. During that conversation, she told me, you're gonna go away. And you're going to think about doing all these things. You're going to go through all your rotations. You're going to, you know, think you're going to be whatever type of doctor. You may go through like 8 or 10 different things you think you want to do, but you'll come back to ophthalmology. I promise you. And sure enough, she was right. And honestly, it was just happenstance that we were teamed up together. And so I really think that played a huge part in me choosing to be an ophthalmologist.
Incredible. Can I follow up with asking you kind of what factors led you to decide on the career in ophthalmology?
Yeah, well, I never really enjoyed hospital medicine. It moved too slowly for me. And I enjoyed more of a fast-paced environment. the nebulous, like, when is my day going to end kind of thing was just very hard for me to wrap my head around. So once I got to do a couple of outpatient rotations, like, oh, I kind of like this a little bit better. Like, there's a defined beginning and end. I kind of know what to expect. It keeps moving pretty quick. I just felt more at home outpatient medicine, and rounding just about killed me. You know, I couldn't do the rounding, the hours and hours talking about, like, you know, COPD management, and which now I barely even know what that is at this point, but I do remember talking about it on rounds. And the interesting thing about rounding with internal medicine in particular, is it seemed like the internal medicine attending just got stronger as rounds went on. Like, they just gained, like, more power and strength and energy. And me, on the other hand, my legs were like lead weights. I was like, please just let us sit down. I need to not be doing, it was just clearly wasn't for me. And so I was very early on turned on to outpatient medicine. And then it was just, you know, do I like surgery? Do I not like surgery? And I did like surgery. And that really kind of cut it down to just a few things, you know, mostly outpatient and doing surgery. And then ophthalmology, I didn't think eyeballs were gross. And that's a huge part of deciding on ophthalmology. Some people have a thing about eyeballs. I loved it. I loved the anatomy. I loved everything about it. And so, yeah, that's kind of what was my thought process going into it.
Makes complete sense. And actually, a lot of medical students that I talk to do wonder, like, how will I know what I'm going to go into? They get very worried at the beginning, first, second year, and even in third year when they don't know.
Yeah, I didn't decide until really the very beginning of my fourth year. I decided very late, and that's fine. You know, you can do, sometimes you can take an extra year to figure it out. And, you know, it's not a decision you want to rush, and it's okay to not know, like, right off the bat.
Oh, I love that you said that. I think you are a role model, and a lot of us do look up to you. And to hear a role model say that, I think means a lot, because there's so much anxiety. We're riddled with it in the early parts of our training. And I hear first year students really worried. And then, as you said, you know, even third year students get more worried. I don't know. So thank you for sharing that. That's actually really helpful and reassuring. Dr. Flannery, can you share your journey of how you wanted to and became a stand-up comedian? Could you share something about that with us?
Well, I don't really identify myself as a stand-up comedian, because it's actually very different than what I do. I have done stand-up comedy. I have a background in stand-up, starting in high school, actually. I grew up in Houston, Texas, and a friend of mine, my best friend from back home, who I still kind of run jokes by him a lot. He actually writes some jokes for me as well. So we're very much like a comedy team a little bit. And he is the funniest person I know. And he was doing stand-up comedy, and he was a year older than me. And so he was 18. And I was like, oh, that sounds like fun. I was always kind of a class clown. I enjoyed, you know, making my friends laugh. And he said, oh yeah, come, you know, check it out. And so I went with him, and I loved it. I got up on stage and I told Jim jokes. Some of them went well, most of them did not, but I kind of caught the bug. Just the whole environment, being around so many other funny people, riffing off each other, throwing jokes around, and seeing what works, what doesn't. One of the best feelings in the world is getting on stage in front of just a random audience and making them laugh, like people you've never met before. It's just an exciting thing to do. But I always thought of it as a hobby, because really since I was, you know, in junior high, I would say, I my mindset was, I want to go to med school. I want to be a doctor. And I loved science. So I knew early on I wanted to go to med school. And so comedy was always kind of just a hobby, just something I just enjoyed doing. And I never really seriously considered it as a career, but it was important to me. It was a big part of my personality. I just enjoyed doing it. And so even though I was on this path to med school and studying, and I continued doing comedy into med school as well. So throughout college and med school, and it just kept that part of myself, which I think really helped me get through med school. It's helped me get through a lot of things in life. But over the years, as my personal life, my professional life has changed and new responsibilities pop up, my comedy has changed. And now it's not as much like going to comedy clubs. In fact, I don't do that. I haven't done that in years. It's more on social media, what you see now, and the podcast I co-host with my wife, and doing speaking engagements at medical conferences to medical audiences. That's how that comedy part of my life has morphed into. And it's really satisfied that creativity that I like to still have in my life.
If I may ask you one follow-up question to that, Nicole and I were talking about something that comes up a lot for students, young people who are starting their careers, their education, and then their training further. One of the biggest things that I've heard students say early on, what they're afraid of losing as they journey into this really difficult and serious profession. A lot of people will say, I'm really worried that I'm going to lose my creativity or my sense of humor or my sense of playfulness or levity, my joy. I mean, those sorts of things feel almost sort of counter to the training of, you know, the heaviness and seriousness. I'm just curious, is that something that you thought about or experienced, you know, early in your training? Like, was there a struggle as though you were swimming upstream and sort of fighting to hold on to?
Yeah, I think for me, it was mostly a time issue, you know, like, because medicine can very easily take over your life, and in some ways good, but also that means there's only so many hours in the day. And so if you're spending so much time practicing medicine or studying, and so I did experience that, you know, when I started my clinical rotations, I actually got away from comedy. I found myself not doing it. I wasn't writing jokes because I was busy. I was on rotations. And it took the first time I was diagnosed with testicular cancer that I realized how much I needed it to process things, to blow off steam. It was such a big part of my life. And so I made myself do it again. And sometimes that's what you have to do, because again, medicine is such a all-encompassing endeavor. And in a lot of ways, our identity is tied up in being physicians, that it's so easy to just lose everything else. And it really, it's not easy. And it takes, like, you have to be like proactive. You have to seek out those other parts of yourself that you know are important, that you love to do, and force yourself to do it. And so even if it's like an hour once a week, you know, whatever it is, your hobby, whatever it is, that thing you like to do, like devote, even if it's such a small amount of time, you like don't give up on it and make yourself do it. Schedule it, because it's going to go away if you don't pay attention to it, if you don't try to like actively nurture that thing. And that's the way it was for me in comedy. And I paid attention to my feelings. Like all of a sudden I was feeling like, God, I really want to tell jokes about this. I really want to talk about this cancer stuff that I'm going through. And so I got back out there and I really haven't stopped since. It's just changed forms. And sometimes you got to be creative in how you continue doing those things. Sometimes that takes a little creativity. Like for me, going from, okay, I know I don't have time to like go to a comedy club that's like 30 minutes away at 11 or midnight or 1 a.m. Maybe instead I'll just go on social media and I can tell jokes there. And so that was a change that I made that still allowed me to be creative and do that thing I love to do, just in a different way than I had done before.
Thank you so much for sharing. I think it's awesome that comedy kind of was re-sparked in your life during a really difficult time. And you've been very vocal about your kind of multiple battles with testicular cancer. Can you share ways that you stayed resilient while fighting this cancer during medical school and then again during residency?
Yeah, when I first was diagnosed, I was toward the end of my third year of med school. And I had a wife and our first kid was about a little over a year old at that point. And so I had them to help and to give me support. And my wife, Kristen, was wonderful then, is wonderful now. And so it was them. It was also, you know, using humor as a coping mechanism, which really helped. When I got that cancer diagnosis, is just like the rug got pulled out from underneath me. It's because I was in my mid 20s and all of a sudden I have cancer. How that there's no way that's not supposed to happen. And so, you know, I just took those feelings and made it my own by adding humor to it and just changing it and presenting it to others and sharing a laugh with other people about that thing. So it's like almost like I was reasserting control over this situation in which I had no control. And it helped. And it helped me process. And I ended up doing a similar thing, you know, 4 years later when I had another diagnosis in residency, in a different way. That was more on social media that I was able to process that. And I talked about it a lot at the time. You know, we all know laughter is a very, you know, healthy, wonderful, you know, coping mechanism for any kind of psychological trauma, any kind of trauma. And so I was using that to the fullest.
I was thinking about your response and just the idea of the control, the concept of being able to have something I can say about it. Have you been able to integrate your comedy into your career in medicine currently? Is it something that you feel is a part of your career, or is it more, like you said earlier, a hobby on the side?
Yeah, it is a part of my career in some ways, in that I wouldn't have my social media presence without my career in medicine. My medical practice, my experience in medicine informs my comedy quite a bit. So if I were to stop practicing medicine, my comedy, my social media, all that stuff would take a hit because it would not seem as genuine. I wouldn't be in it, so to speak, and I wouldn't have that connection to it. That being said, I try very hard to keep my professional life as an ophthalmologist and my life as Dr. Glockenflecken as separate as possible. I don't talk about my personal practice so much. I don't like plug my private practice in my videos like a lot of, you know, doctors on social media will do, you know, to try to gain notoriety, which is not a wrong thing to do. It's just I choose not to do it because I want to have this thing that I really feel like is separate from my day job, because my day job as a practicing ophthalmologist has all these stressors, and I want to be able to just not involve the two and keep that thing separate for all the reasons we've already talked about. You know, it's good to have something that you can hold on to that's not medicine related, not job related, you know. And so, yeah, I try very hard to keep those separate, and it gets harder and harder because I do have to answer Glockenflecken emails like on my lunch break, and it's hard sometimes to keep them completely separate, but I do the best I can. There's no doubt that they are related to each other, and I really can't do one without the other.
And does humor come into your daily practice? Do you find that because you're so connected to laughter and that's such an integral part of your nature and your personality and what gives you strength, do you find that you bring humor into your patient interactions?
Yeah, I do sometimes. It's very different though, because you have to have a very safe type of humor with patients. And that's mainly because you don't know a lot of these people. You don't know what their values are. You don't know what their life experiences are. In the end, they are not there to hear a comedy routine, as opposed to people on social media who are there to, they see me pop up, they expect to laugh. So it's a different expectation for people that come in to see me as a physician. Now, that being said, I do love, because there's no faster way to form a relationship with a patient than sharing a laugh. That is absolutely 100% the fastest way to develop rapport. If you can make someone laugh in 2 or 3 minutes, you might as well spend 30 minutes with them. And so I do have like a dad jokes, so to speak, like, you know, kind of just off the cuff. And everybody should have some of these, right? Because we're saying a lot of the same things over and over again, right? So we all will have little things that we pick up over the course of our career that we know is going to get like a good laugh. And those are always safe. I never take chances with that. It's stuff that's, you know, very mild. And I take more risks whenever I'm making content on social media. So it's just a different type of thing. But I do try to, you know, when I can in my 10-minute encounters, you know, introduce a little bit of humor. And a lot of it's reading the patient as well. Some people are open to the idea of humor. Some people, you can tell, they're maybe not too happy and they wouldn't be as receptive to it. And just like a big part of comedy and just being funny on a daily basis and is understanding your audience. And that's very similar to you know, practicing medicine. You get a vibe for what the patient's open to.
Shiva and I were also talking about earlier, just being in medicine, it is known as kind of one of those more formal careers. And oftentimes finding that balance between wanting to be professional, not only with your patients, but with your colleagues, but then kind of bringing your own personality, your humor into it. And definitely as an intern right now in emergency medicine, trying to figure out how do I maintain being professional, but then also bring my personality and bring humor, you know, with my colleagues, because we go through a lot of different really difficult things and humor can definitely help.
Oh, and you should. Yeah, it's so important that every doctor be able to express themselves. The era of hiding your emotions and your thoughts and feelings is over. That needs to stop, because that introduces a whole host of other problems for you as the person hiding your emotions. And it's also not good for patient-physician relationships, because I can tell you from my experiences as a patient, I want my doctor to like have a personality, to know that they have real feelings, that they laugh, they tell jokes sometimes, there are things that bother them about medicine, about whatever it is. Like it's okay to show that. And there's, you know, this long-standing, you know, for decades, this idea that you can't, that's not professional, right? To do that as a physician, you need to be the stoic fountain of encyclopedic knowledge of medicine. And you can't show that side of you. And I do think that's changing. Social media is helping that change. But there's a balance, right? Just like you said, there's a balance, because we have this unique position in society where we're taking care of patients' lives. Well, not me, their eyes, but not their lives, but you know, other people, their lives. And so we have this special place, and so we need to honor that and make sure we do maintain a level of professionalism, but it should not come at the expense of our own self-expression. That should not happen. We owe it to our patients and to ourselves to show who we are and talk about those things. Because a lot of times that's what's going to help also medicine change for the better, is that we're talking about these things, right? We're talking about the things that irritate us, the health insurance companies that piss us off, and the things that they, you know, all that stuff. That's all good stuff. Like we need to get that out there, social media and otherwise.
I couldn't agree more. We're all human, and that human connection, I think it really is important to show. So I know we, as well as our listeners, are dying to know, how did you come up with the stage name Dr. Glockenflecken?
It's actually a word in ophthalmology, believe it or not. There's like a real thing called Glockenflecken. Although I apologize to Dr. the original Glockenflecken who came up with the name Glockenflecken. I don't know if it's a person, it probably wasn't. Because now when you like search Glockenflecken, I come up much more than the actual like physical exam term that's been there for like 300 years. But it's a finding that you see an angle closure glaucoma of all things. You said you're emergency medicine, right?
Yeah.
So angle closure glaucoma, that's the thing that you should know about, right?
100%.
High pressure in the eye, you get these little grayish white flecks that develop inside the eye that are called Glockenflecken. And the reason I chose it, because it's clearly not a hilarious, I mean, it's a hilarious word, but the meaning is absolutely not funny. The reason I chose it is because I was trying to come up with the most ridiculous word in ophthalmology, which there's a wealth of ridiculous words in ophthalmology. So I had no shortage of options and just decided to go with Glockenflecken. I thought it sounded funny. Maybe I should have chosen an easier name to say. People struggle with it, which provides me a lot of comedy when I get to hear people try to say Glockenflecken. I've gotten all kinds. I've gotten like Glockenflocken, glaucoma flecken, glockenspiel. That was my favorite. You know, it's all over the place. So but anyway, that's the origin.
I love it. Yeah, no, Shiva and I practiced over and over. We're like, we cannot butcher this name.
It's perfect. Yeah, that's right. No, man, it's more famous than my actual last name. No one knows Will Flannery. I'm Dr. Glock. I'm Dr. G to a lot of people. So
I love it. I feel like there's so many words in medicine. You're just like, that must be a Harry Potter spell. Like, there's just so many words to choose from, but...
It sounds like it, kind of, yeah. It was either that or Dr. Pseudophakodinesis. But that was a little bit too much.
You know, Shiva, I think something's missing. You know, I think we're not in our true characters.
Oh, nice.
So for listeners at home, I have put on my bike helmet and my biker glasses. Shiva is putting on her glasses as well.
I'm family medicine.
slightly askew, I see. Hair's a little messed up, a little burned out, a little stressed out.
A little bit out of sort, a little tired. I think I should work harder. I loved your alter ego. The family medicine was so perfect. Like, I could do more. I could sleep less. I could definitely do more. I could get paid a lot less. I get paid you know, minimum. So
I love it. Well, one of the things that I think drew us, or at least me, to a lot of your videos on social media were the different doctor stereotypes that you portray. How did you come up with these characters, and how do you walk the line between making people laugh but also trying not to offend the different specialties?
Yeah, I mean, the personalities, the caricatures, they kind of speak for themselves. Like, all their personalities in medicine have been the same since the end of time. Like, a neurologist probably 200 years ago is just the same as a neurologist today. I don't know that for a fact, but I have to assume that it's true, because the feedback I get from people all over the world is, oh, it's the same here as it is there. And so I really think there's something to it, and that helps that. Helps my content spread around the world is because people identify with these personalities. And I don't know if it's like the people just are born, have these personalities that direct them to, like, a chicken or the egg thing. Do they have a personality that's more like a neurosurgeon, so they end up being a neurosurgeon, or do they go into neurosurgery and become a neurosurgeon? I don't know. Probably a little bit of both. But they're so unique. They're all so different. And so in coming up with them, like, for, I'll just, like, emergency medicine, I think I had one video where I knew, I've known it, like, several, like, hardcore biking, like, that's the thing with emergency medicine. They're like adrenaline junkies, right? They love, I think at one point I told a joke about, like, rock climbing into work. Like, you know, it's that kind of personality. I was at a conference once and I ran to an emergency medicine doctor, and he said that he couldn't stay and talk with me because he had to go kite surfing. So it's just like that kind of thing that comes up over and over again. And so it was very easy to come up with that costume, right? And for most of my costumes, it's stuff I have around the house. So that bike helmet's like 20 years old at this point. And emergency medicine doctors point out to me at all times, really, you're going to use that bike helmet? Like, okay, sir, thank you for, like, reinforcing my stereotype here. That's great. They just seem to make sense. I don't know. Now they're, like, taking on a life of their own, right? So, like, people know what the costume is and the glasses for family medicine. You know, obviously I wanted them to seem overworked and undervalued, because they are, right? That's, like, primary care across the board is overworked and undervalued. And in terms of portraying these specialties without getting myself into trouble, I make fun of the day-to-day things. I make fun of kind of some of the personality traits, but there are certain lines I don't cross. I never ridicule anybody's purpose for what they're doing, like the reason they want to be a particular type of doctor. So it doesn't go deep like that. It's all kind of surface level, you know, idiosyncrasies, and they're hard to refute as well, because, like, they're true. It's all this stuff I'm talking about. You don't understand how much research I do to, like, come up with these videos. I do a lot of research. I'm getting on, like, internet message board, like Reddit threads from, like, 10 years ago. Like, I Google, like, you know, general surgery pet peeves and find, like, stuff people talked about from, like, 2008 on Twitter. I spend a lot of time gathering all this information, and you can really glean a lot about personalities and different specialties just based on what people are posting about on social media. And so I really let that inform my comedy. And then I just don't take cheap shots. You know, I keep it respectful of the profession while still being able to make fun of the daily things that we all identify with those specialties. And I also make fun of myself just as much as I make fun of other people. So I am the first person to make fun of ophthalmologists. I do it all the time. So that helps as well, knowing that I'm not focusing in on one specialty. I'm kind of an equal opportunity comedian when it comes to that.
I love hearing about all the research you do. You it just is so natural that I think most of us have the idea that it just flows out of you because they're all living in you somehow.
Well, at first maybe a little bit, but the longer I'm an ophthalmologist, the less I know about anything outside of ophthalmology. So I have to do it, because I don't know anything about neonatology. What am I going to talk about? I got to learn this stuff. I'm fairly good at just coming up with joke structure and being able to the comedic timing and my acting has gotten better too. So that helps with the videos. There's also a lot in the editing that helps, you know, enhance the humor. And so, you know, some of it's production value, which isn't great, but it's good enough. But I'm just pretty good at taking little things, little stereotypes of different specialties and turning them into a conversation about something.
It does bring so much joy to so many of us. And I know that must make you very happy.
Yeah, yeah. I enjoy it. It's nice to get that feedback. I like it when people can laugh at themselves too, you know, and so I think that's a really important ability, especially for a profession that tends to take itself very, very seriously, sometimes for good reason, but probably to a fault as well. And so we all need to be able to laugh at ourselves a little bit.
I would say definitely to a fault. I think I actually consider loss of humor an occupational hazard for going into medicine. It's such a serious business, and so much of the training is so focused on the intellect, you know, and that aspect of our cognitive function, that our humor and our creativity and that, like we said, the playful side of us and being able to be light and take ourselves less seriously is all but lost. But you're really helping to bring that, especially, I think, well, not just to the younger generation, to all generations who are in medicine. That's why, you know, so many multi-generational and multinational people relate to you, because you're helping us really be reminded of how funny a lot of this is. And a lot of us are.
Oh, man. Medicine is so funny. It's such a unique job. We do so many strange things, and our language is so weird, and we say the same things over and over again. And it's all our personal interactions with each other. Like, you notice, I never have patient characters. I never depict a patient, and I do that purposefully. I could easily, right. I could easily like do lots of jokes and skits around like direct patient care, but that's not appropriate in my mind. There's so much material just with our own interactions with each other in medicine. It's this whole little ecosystem we have of interpersonal conflicts and relationships, that there's a lot of comedy there to be had.
Oh my God, it's true. We know that cancer wasn't the only obstacle that you've had to go through and overcome at such a young age. You've also shared publicly that when you were only 34, you suddenly went into cardiac arrest while you were asleep, and your wife had to do CPR, and thankfully got the great help from the 911 operator and saved your life, really. You woke up in the ICU 3 days later, just, I know, filled with gratitude and not even knowing what you went through, but I know your wife went through a lot. And now that you've gone through that, it's really a tremendously traumatic experience that I don't think anyone can truly understand. But having gone through that, and thank goodness you are well and you survived that, how did that incident change your life, your relationship with your wife, your views on medicine? I know that's a big question, and I'm sure you've thought about it a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it changes over time how it affects your life. You know, initially there's just relief, you know, when you come home finally. This was at the peak of COVID, and so my family couldn't be in the hospital with me, which is one of the great travesties that we've done to people as part of the pandemic, is separated them from their families in the hospital. And so it was just immediately there was gratitude. And then there's also just recognition for the wonderful things in your life. You know, that's kind of, it's a cliche, but that's, you know, you just feel lucky, you know, that you have your kids, you have your family, and you're really paying attention in those moments. And, you know, that, I think that's part of just the immediate aftermath of having a near-death experience. And that does tend to fade, because you get back into your daily routine, but there's still, those feelings still hit you from time to time. And it's random, you know. It's like you do something for the first time with your kid. You go to a baseball game or whatever it is, and all of a sudden you just kind of get hit with, oh man, I almost didn't get to see, you know, my daughter score her first goal in basketball. And it's a fleeting moment. It just lasts for a little bit, but they still happen. And they're still happening to me. It's been almost, you know, like 3 years now since the cardiac arrest. And I kind of hope it never stops happening, you know, in a way. I don't think about it every day like I used to. So it's not an everyday thing, but it's nice to have those little moments of just relief and gratitude and love and all these things. From a personal standpoint, kind of what these first 3 years have been like. professionally, you know, I took a month off from work, and probably when I first came back, one of the things I remember the most was actually like extreme empathy fatigue, and which I was not expecting. You know, I'd be in clinic and I'd have patients come in with, you know, some kind of eye problem. But in my mind, it's like, how could you possibly like be bothered by this? Like, don't you know what I just went through? Well, no, they don't know what I went through. But that in my mind, it was like this feeling like this is nothing compared to what I just experienced. And it's kind of scared me to feel that way, because I recognize that that's not okay. It's like almost like I couldn't help it, though. It was a very strange feeling right when I first came back to work, because it's the patient's there for a problem. My problem is not their problem. And so it took a little bit of time for that to completely go away, but it was something that I did not expect to happen when I came back to work after that. And that's since gone. You know, unfortunately, that's not something that lasted, but it was a little bit alarming to me as someone who feels like I'm a fairly empathetic person as a physician. And also just from a practical standpoint, listening to patients, hearing about their medical issues, I'm able to relate a little bit more, their experiences as patients, interacting with the healthcare system, insurance, all that stuff. I'm a little bit more adept at relating to what they're going through and being able to talk about it, being open to talking about like insurance issues and stuff like that. So there have been some real benefits to going through what I went through when it comes to patient care.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Such a deeply life-changing experience, and I know it'll continue.
Here on Meaningful Medicine Podcast, we appreciate how you use your platform to inform viewers, both healthcare workers and non-healthcare workers, about various topics on navigating medical school to the horrors of sleeping in your contact lenses. I've definitely done this a couple times myself, don't want to admit that. But what topics are you most passionate about sharing with your audience?
These days, I love talking about our healthcare system, because it's like enshrouded in mystery to a lot of the public, and it's purposefully complicated and difficult to navigate. And I really try to challenge myself with certain topics that are definitely complicated, even for a physician who's in healthcare, to understand, but be able to portray this issue or this thing or this person or whatever it is in a way that allows everybody, regardless of whether or not you're in medicine, to understand it. So something like pharmacy benefit managers, which is something that I honestly didn't even know existed until like a year ago. And it's a complicated middleman type of person that just extracts money from the healthcare system. There's a lot of things that do that in the healthcare system, but I was able to kind of figure out what this person does in healthcare and shed light on it and show like, look what's happening here. And then I get feedback from people that were saying, I had no idea like this was a thing. And I really appreciate that kind of feedback, especially from people who are not in medicine, because now they're aware of this thing that affects them. It affects all of us in a negative way. And now they know what it is, and they've heard the words, and they have something that they can go back and watch again if they want to. And so I really like educating people on the healthcare system. So that's probably, I'd say, my favorite thing. I love it. That and making fun of neurosurgeons. That's also very fun.
Both are important. equally.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And over the last few years, your popularity on social media has skyrocketed, to say the least, and you've become a household name in medicine. Medical students, residents, people who are practicing, obviously here and all over the world. And in the past, you've raised over $100,000 for a charity called First Ascents that supports young adults who've been diagnosed with cancer. And you did this while your wife also started the Glaucom Flecken LLC. the LLC advocates for co-survivors of medical trauma and critical illness as she's gone through cancer diagnoses and treatments. And do you and your wife have any long-term goals for making a lasting impact, which you have already had, but longer-term goals, especially again, now that you have such a large social media following?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly, continuing our philanthropy with young adult cancer survivors, every year we raise more money for First Descents, which is an organization based out of Colorado that brings a group of young adult cancer survivors and cancer patients on these week-long outdoor adventure-like activities. And it's just a way for people, an often overlooked demographic, which is young adults with cancer, together to form a support network, where it's really hard to find a support network whenever you're 23 and you have cancer. And so it was vital for me to be able to experience that. And so we want to continue doing that every year to just help send more young adults on those trips to form their own support network. And then Kristen is doing phenomenal work for co-survivors and co-survivorship. And one of the things that we want to do is help create some type of information course. I don't know what it's going to be yet, but something to help co-survivors and just show why it's important to recognize co-survivors of medical trauma. Because in my example, you know, the story of my cardiac arrest ultimately is her story, because I was unconscious. I didn't know what was going on. I just woke up in the ICU a couple days later. That was it. But she lived every single second of that. And we don't recognize that enough in the medical field, the effect that these major, major medical traumas have on the family members, the friends, the people that respond to people and perform chest compressions. These have real impacts on people, psychological impacts. And recognizing that and giving them a framework for how to process and how to seek help and what some resources for those people. So those are areas of interest for us. I would also like to do a lot with regard to just shedding more light on the healthcare industry and some of the major issues that we're facing with you know, regulatory hurdles and prior authorizations and denials and all this stuff. I'll keep putting Jimothy to work and that poor guy has to work with the United Healthcare executives. So yeah, those are our areas that we're trying to make a difference in, for sure.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing. It's been so amazing to have you on the podcast today. As we wrap up, can you share some advice to trainees who are looking to create or reestablish their own creative outlets to help themselves and others find joy in medicine the way you have done by bringing laughter to so many of us in the field?
I think whatever it is you're doing, whether it's like creating content or riding your bike, you know, whatever your hobby or your focus is, do it for yourself. Don't do it for others, because it's going to be more fulfilling. You're doing, this is your thing. This is it fulfilling for you. And that's what's helped me kind of keep it fun, is that I'm doing this ultimately for me, and it just so happens to also benefit people. Like, people really like it, but it needs to stay fun for me to do it. Otherwise, it's just going to be a negative on my own mental health, and it's not going to be as impactful for others too. And that's the way it should be with any kind of hobby or any kind of creative passion or outlet that you have. Do it for yourself, because goodness knows we need something that's going to fill our bucket in medicine. And so if you're passionate about it, doesn't matter if you're creating content on social media, you know, and you don't have to have a bunch of followers. If you're passionate about it and you put the time into it and it's fun for you, like, people will pay attention to it, and you'll get a following if you want one. But it just, don't give up on it though. And that was, we talked about that earlier, you know, even if it's just for a few minutes every week, an hour, you know, keep it going. And that would be my best advice.
That's wonderful advice. We want to just thank you so much, Will, for joining us for this really special time with you. It was something we've really looked forward to, and we feel very grateful for not just having you, but really the wisdom and the kindness and the love that you've shared with us is just palpable, and it just makes Dr. Glaucum Flecken all the more all the more enjoyable and adorable to us.
Doing a great job with the name.
Thank you. I've been practicing. That's the only thing I've said all week. Good. Yeah. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so, so much. This is awesome.
Thank you for tuning in today
and allowing us to be one of your meaningful moments.
Please rate, review, and subscribe, and share with friends, family, and colleagues. Meaningful Medicine was produced by Shiva Kayambashi, Nicole Hohenstein, David Elkin, Nikki Elkin, Ahaley Chattopadhyay, and Leigh Kodama. Editing by Nicole Hohenstein, Nikki Elkin, and Leigh Kodama. Intro and closing by Daniel Wendling. On Meaningful Medicine, we are careful to ensure that all stories are compliant with healthcare privacy laws, and details may have been changed to ensure patient confidentiality. All views expressed are of the person speaking and not their employer.